All right, let's do a quick review of where we're at here. We're talking about how do you talk to your friends about Christianity? How do you introduce them to Jesus Christ? And we said yesterday that Christianity is based in history on a real person that actually lived. If you look in the Encyclopedia Britannica, you can find 20,000 words listed about Jesus, and they never hint that he didn't exist. Why? Because anybody that does a history of the first 100 years, 100 AD, anybody that does a history, writes a history, has to include Jesus Christ in there because there were people that gave us historical information about him that every historian recognizes. As we said, there were eight, at least, eyewitnesses or people who claimed that they had contact with the eyewitnesses who wrote the books of the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, James, Peter, and Jude. These men claimed, as we saw yesterday, to have contact with eyewitnesses or to be eyewitnesses themselves. But then we came to what the universities are teaching today, and the universities are teaching, yeah, they claim that, but the fact is, really, we think that it's like going to the party where you whisper a sentence into the ear of one person, it goes all the way down the line and comes out distorted over here, and they're saying Jesus did his stuff over here, and by the time it was written down, we know that because 200 years or so went by, the fact is it couldn't have been historically accurate. Now, that's what we're dealing with, and we saw, first of all, that goes against the very claims that we find in the books of the New Testament. They claimed that it wasn't 200 years later, but they were right on the spot. They saw it. They were there. What they saw, what they heard, that's what they are proclaiming, declaring, writing to you. Paul says, I assure you before God, I am not writing to you a lie. All right? So they claimed it. But what else can we now marshal to back up the claim that we have accurate information about Jesus? And where we're going is, first of all, do we have accurate information about Jesus? If we can conclude that we do, then we want to see in those documents what Jesus claimed about himself. Did he ever say that he was God? Now again, I am not taking the Bible as a book that dropped out of heaven that's inspired and inerrant. I believe that it is, but I'm not taking it that way this morning. If you're a non-Christian, I'm simply saying, can I look at these books, these authors, and do they give me accurate information? The guy that writes the roadmaps for this country doesn't claim to be inspired by God, but we think he gives us information that's accurate. So all I want to find out is, do we have evidence that shows these books are accurate in what they depict about Jesus? Then we'll find out what they said about Jesus and what Jesus said about himself, and then we'll draw some conclusions. Now, I want to give you about the time when the books of the New Testament were written. I want to give you an argument that maybe you've never heard before. I want to start with the book of Acts, and I want to date that. Then I want to work back on the Gospels. I think you'll find this interesting. I want to give you four reasons why the book of Acts must have been written at least before or no later than 62 A.D. 62 A.D. Four reasons. Okay, are you ready? Reason number one is that the fall of Jerusalem is not mentioned in the book of Acts. I think that you know that Christianity spread out from Jerusalem, and it was the primary city. It's where the apostles were at. And Acts records the first happenings of the church at Jerusalem, and then how it started to spread. Well, if, as you know, when did Jerusalem get destroyed? 70 AD. How did it happen? The Roman soldiers came. The Emperor Nero dispatched, first of all, Vespasian to this area. And then Nero committed suicide in 68 AD. When Nero committed suicide, Vespasian became the emperor, and then he gave to his son Titus the responsibility of conquering Jerusalem. Titus took four legions of Roman soldiers, went up and laid siege to Jerusalem, and in 70 AD, he conquered the city, he burned it, and he slaughtered the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Now that's a pretty hairy act. And if the book of Acts talks a lot about what happened in Jerusalem, why didn't Luke put the destruction of Jerusalem in there? Why? Because it hadn't happened yet. So number one, is the fall of Jerusalem tells me it's got to be at least before 70 AD that this book was written. Otherwise, the fall of Jerusalem would have been recorded. Number two, Nero's persecution is not mentioned in the book of Acts. Now, there were two persecutions that Nero did. One was in 64, another one in 68. And there are some words in the book of Acts concerning some of the local persecutions, but nothing about the emperor's edict across the whole Roman Empire that this Christian should be hunted down and killed, and some of the stories that were told later on. None of that is mentioned in the book of Acts. So why isn't it mentioned? Because the book of Acts was written before that. So we're now before 64 AD. Third reason would be this. The Apostle Paul is still living when the book of Acts comes to an end. The Apostle Paul is one of the central characters that is written about in the book of Acts. It's almost his biography, if you want. And when you are spending so much time on a person and talking about what he did, what he taught, what he said, and so on, when you come to the point of his death, that's kind of key in a biography. It ends it. The fact is, they didn't put anything about Paul's death. Why? When did Paul die? Well, most people think that he died in the first Neronian persecution of 64 AD. And because Luke does not record Paul's death, Paul is still living, he's confined to jail at that time, then again, we have a third reason why Acts had to be written before 64 AD. Fourth reason, there are two other central figures that could have been mentioned. The Apostle Peter and James are still living. And we know that Peter died, well, we know approximately that he died about 65 AD, and James is said to have died at 62 AD. But when Acts is done, they're still alive. And remember that other deaths were recorded. For example, Luke records the fact of Stephen and James, the brother of John. Both of these people, they died, and they're recorded. Well, Peter and Paul and some of the others, they were more important than those figures. Again, why weren't these people and their deaths mentioned? Because Acts was written before 62 AD. Now, all I want to do is to get that into your head, is 62 AD is approximately where the book of Acts ought to be placed. Okay? So let's start there. Now, what do we know about Acts? Acts is book 2 of what? Of Luke. The Gospel of Luke came first. How do we know that? Well, Luke says so. He says in Acts chapter 1, in my former book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and to teach. That's what the Gospel of Luke is about. But if it's the former book, that means it came first. So now we have 62 AD is when Acts was written, and if Luke, the Gospel of Luke, was written before that, we have to have that before 62 AD. Where would we place that? Well, how about putting that at about 58 AD, just a few years before Acts was written. But then, if you have Luke at about 58, almost all of the scholars say, you got Acts here at 62, you got Luke at 58, all of the scholars say that Matthew came before Luke. And so you have people like William F. Albright and Dr. John A.T. Robinson saying that we've got to put Matthew over here at about 50 to 55 A.D. in front of the Gospel of Luke. Okay, you following me so far? Now going on back, they say, and almost all the scholars, probably 95% of them would say that we got Mark had to come beforehand because there are sections of Mark that show up in both Matthew and in Luke that they use some of the material from Mark. And so therefore, it had to come even before Matthew. Well, if Matthew's at 50 to 55, some of them have put Mark at 45, and both William F. Albright and John A.T. Robinson put Mark as early as 40 A.D. Now, what's the significance of all this? Well, if you look at Harold Honer's book, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ, which documents archaeologically how Jesus died at 33 A.D., at 33 A.D., Jesus died. 40 Matthew, or Mark, is on the newsstands. By 50, Matthew, 58, Luke, and then 62, the book of Acts. Now, what does that tell us? It tells me we've got accurate information. Because again, if these books came out 7 years 15 years, 20 years, actually from, say, 30, let's take it from 62 down to 33, 29 years for all of the Gospels and the book of Acts. What does that tell us? Well, remember I told you yesterday that you have been living now for 32 years since the time of Kennedy's death? All of the Gospels, if you were living in Jesus' day, would have already been on the newsstands while you're still here. And just like you can remember the events about Kennedy, the people, both pro and con, could remember seeing Jesus. He was a controversial figure. As we showed in Mark chapter 2 yesterday, the fact is the very scribes were in one of these hairy meetings where this guy comes down out of the roof and Jesus uses that fellow to show that he's deity. All I want you to know is that when you look at the Gospels, the dates of the Gospels of when these books were written show that we have accurate information. As Peter was preaching in Acts, he was preaching to two kinds of people. Let's talk about those two kinds of people. Number one, if you have people that love Jesus in the audience and Peter is preaching about the person that they love, are they going to watch what he says? You better believe it. Why? Because they love Jesus. Don't mess around with this guy that I love. I follow him. He's my Lord. He's my God. Now, I'm going to be careful about what you say. I want to hear exactly what you're saying because maybe they were right there at the scene when Jesus said it. Then you have the people that were in the audience that were hostile to Jesus, that hated his guts. And they would have loved to prove that these men and what they were saying were wrong. And the apostles were preaching to this kind of a crowd constantly. And their books came out when those people, both those that loved Jesus and those that were hostile to him, were still living and could remember back to actually being there and watching Jesus do this stuff and say this stuff. That's why F.F. Bruce at Manchester said, it just can't be legend, it can't be myth. They couldn't have padded the case because there were too many interested people that were eyewitnesses that could have corrected them if they were wrong. Okay? That tells me we have accurate information. Now, another area that tells me that we have accurate information is archaeology. Archaeology. All right? Now, we've been talking a lot about Luke. He's got Acts. He's got the Gospel of Luke. There was a fellow by the name of Sir William Ramsay from the school at Tübingen in Germany. Ramsay was one of the higher critics. And he really didn't believe that these guys were eyewitnesses of Jesus' life. But he was one of the world's greatest archaeologists, and he went to the Holy Land to kind of prove his thesis. When he got down to the Holy Land, he would start to shovel and unearth the mud and the clay and so on, and he would find rocks with inscriptions, and as he read them, he found out that his assumptions were wrong and that Luke was right. Now let me give you an idea of what I'm talking about. In terms of language. Now we had Frank Peretti here last night. Okay, I don't know. Frank, are you here this morning? Okay. Now, if Frank writes for another 30 years, if the Lord tarries, the words that he'll be using in his book will probably reflect our culture and be a little different than what they are right now. For example, do you remember during the 60s? Some of you can think back that far. The fact is that the teenagers used words like what? Cool and groovy and stuff like that. Well, we don't use those words anymore. Why not? Because those words were part of the 60s to the 70s. Okay? So if you read a book today and the characters are using the word cool and groovy, we would date it right around 1960 to 1970, right in that area. Okay? Then all of a sudden we got these words like awesome. That started coming up. If you listen to these little kids, they can really inform you what the culture is really talking about, okay? What I'm saying is that you use certain kinds of words all along the line. For example, do you think that 100 years from now, when the historians are writing about America, that they will call President Clinton Slick Willie? See, we have a little term here for the president that probably will not make any sense to the guys 100 years from now. I wonder what does Slick Willie mean, all right? So, Ramsay goes into the Holy Land, and he's uncovering the rocks and so on, and just like we've got Slick Willie and other things for other presidents along the way, they had it about kings and rulers of their own day. Sometimes the emperors laid it on themselves. They gave themselves special names apart from their real name, okay? And only the people that lived in that slice of history knew about it. Well, Ramsay goes into the Holy Land, thinks that Luke is one of these guys that's a mythical figure that just used the name of Luke and really didn't even know the events, wasn't an eyewitness on the scene. He was just 200 years later. But he goes and he starts unearthing the rocks and he finds out that Luke, in his book, in naming the emperors, the rulers, the cities, the geographical areas, he knows all of the secret names that are on the rocks that were right from that period. And all of a sudden it starts to dawn on Ramsay, he couldn't have known that unless he was actually there and living in that period of time. He was more accurate than any of the people that were in Germany just writing about their thoughts. He had been right on the scene. And Ramsay changed his mind completely about Luke and said that he was one of the greatest historians of that time. They checked Luke via archaeology in these categories. Now listen to this. Luke mentioned 32 different countries in the Gospel of Luke and in Acts, 54 different cities, 9 different islands, several rulers, and when they checked him out archaeologically, all the special names, all of the cute names of the time period, Luke never made one mistake. He was accurate in every one of those areas. Now, if he is accurate in everything that you can check, then in the areas that you cannot check, you've got to give him the benefit of the doubt because he's already established his credibility. He is an accurate historical writer. And when he says, I checked out everything carefully, I investigated everything carefully, if you can document that from archaeology that that is the case, then in everything else that he tells you, you've got to give him the benefit of the doubt. You have to. So archaeology tells me that we have accurate information. Then I want to just try this out on you because it's so crucial, these documents. When you read U.S. News, who was Jesus and time when it'll come out again this year, all of these guys come to the same area, and I want to show you how biased the press is. I would like to talk about, again, I'm not saying these books are inspired or inerrant, I just want to have accurate information. And I want to make a statement now, and I want to back it up. And that is that if you're an intellectual, I would say this on any university campus, if you're an intellectual and you know the classics, the Greek classics, you know ancient history, the fact is, if you will not accept the documents that we have in the New Testament from Matthew through Revelation, if you're going to throw this out, then you're going to have to throw out Aristotle, Plato, Thucydides, Homer, you're going to have to throw out the classics. You say, wow. You back that up? Yeah, I can. I want to tell you why. First of all, let me tell you something about documents today. You know, let's say you've got Aristotle writing around 400 B.C., before Christ. Well, they didn't have printing presses back there, right? So what happened? They would write it on material that would disappear. And as this material, papyrus or whatever, would start to disappear, in order to preserve it, they'd have to recopy it. You didn't have a printing press, so you had to recopy it again. And then as that copy got a little bit soiled and started to disintegrate, you have to copy it again. Now my question to you is, do you know how much time transpired between the time that Aristotle wrote and the first copy that has come down to us and survived? How much time? Another way of saying it, how much time is in there that we've got nothing? 1,400 years went by that we don't know what in the world transpired. That is that Aristotle wrote about 384 B.C., and the fact is the first copy that we have that exists now in the museums and so on, is 1100 A.D. It's marked at 1100 A.D. Now, what I love is that even though we have that big gap from the time that he wrote to the time that we have the first manuscript that exists, if you would ask any classical scholar, does that bother you? Do you think that because we have a big gap there and we don't know what transpired or who copied or whatever, we have nothing that goes right back 1,400 years to actually when Aristotle wrote, that we got this gaposis there? Does that bother you? Do you think that we don't have an accurate copy of what he said? Do You think that somebody messed with the manuscript? You think that somehow that somebody down the line added stuff to it so that we don't really know accurately what he said? No! There's not one classical scholar that doubts that what we have now, 1,400 years from the time that he wrote, is exactly what the man said. Okay, just hold on to this now. Just hold on to this. How about Plato? Plato wrote about 427 to 347 B.C. The first manuscript that we've got is 900 A.D. 1,200-year gap in terms of the manuscripts coming down. Thucydides and his wars. 496 to 406 is when he wrote. The earliest copy that we've got in existence is 1,000 A.D. That means there's a 1,400-year time span from the time that he wrote to the first manuscript that exists today. Sophocles wrote about 496 to 406 B.C. The earliest copy is dated at 1,000 A.D. There's a 1,400-year time span. And yet they all say that basically we have an accurate account of what these authors originally wrote and said. But they'll come to the New Testament and say, we haven't got accurate stuff. You Christians just believe anything, don't you? The time span from the time that the writers wrote to the first copies that you have is so long that we can't believe that you have accurate historical information. How long is it, by the way? Let me give you a couple ideas here. They were down in Egypt, and they found five verses from the Gospel of John. They are dated as being written at 117 A.D. It's called the John Rylands Papyrus. Obviously, these are copies, but if John wrote and ended his book at 80 A.D., that means that the time, from the time that he wrote and the copy that got down that they found that's dated at 117 is 37 years. 37 years versus 1,400 years over here. They have no doubt that what this guy said over here is right. 37 years over here. We feel like a piker over here. 37 years. But they say, well, you know, I mean, look what happened in between the Gaphosis where you don't have the Apostle John sitting there writing. We just have a copy. 37 years old. The ink is hardly dry. The Bottomer papyri are dated at 175 to 225. They contain most of the Gospel of Luke and most of the Gospel of John. That would mean that these are only 110 years away from the apostles. The Chester Beatty papyri are dated at 250 A.D., three codices that contain most of the New Testament. This would put them at 180 years from the time of the apostles. The major manuscripts that have the whole Bible, the Codex Vaticanus, dated at 325 A.D., and Codex Sinaiticus at 350 A.D., these would be only 255 years away from the apostles. Now, neighbors, I want to say it again. If you will not accept the New Testament writers as giving accurate historical information, what are you going to have to do with Plato, Aristotle, Thucydides, and Sophocles? You're going to have to chuck them. I don't know any classical scholar, in order to not deal with the New Testament, is willing to chuck the entire classics. They're not that biased. Let me give you another illustration. How many copies do we have for the New Testament compared to Aristotle, Plato, and so on? Let me give you an illustration. Let's say you're a school teacher and you're in class, and you have the Gettysburg Address, and you give the Gettysburg Address out to 100 kids in your class, and you say, write this out. So they all write. Then when they're done writing, you say, take the original copy and throw it in the trash can. So they all do that. Now, the question is, from those kids that have written, how close can you get back to the original Gettysburg Address? Well, every school teacher knows that in the class you have A students, B students, C students, and my friends. And when you're looking at the D student's copy of the Gettysburg Address, it's a wonder to behold. The C students are a little better, the B students, and then the A students, even the A students will make some errors. Some will misspell words, some will not put the grammar correct, some will not have punctuation correct, some might skip a line. But if you're trying to put together the original, is it better to have just, say, 4 copies or 100 copies to try to put the original together. Well, the more that you have, the better it is. Because 100 students aren't going to make the same mistake in the same spot. They'll make it in different places. And the fact is, when you know who the A students are, you'll look at theirs and give theirs a little more credibility. But the fact is, if 95 of the kids have recorded a word that's in there at the front of a sentence correctly, you say, most likely that's where it's supposed to be. And 5 kids missed it, you say, well, we can understand that, especially if they're C students. Now, what I'm saying is that when you try to put together an original copy, the more manuscripts that you have, copies that have come down, the more copies that you have in your possession to do that, the better it is. The more helpful it is, because you can compare all of the different manuscripts. If you only have 2, if they're D students, you're in big trouble. Now let's talk about that in terms of who's got the most manuscripts to give us the most accurate information. The New Testament or the Greek classics? Well, how many books do we have in existence that have come down? Copies of Aristotle. We have 49 copies that have come down. How many we have of Plato? Only 7. How many copies have come down from Sophocles? 193. How many of Thucydides? 8. How many of Catullus, the poet? 3 copies. 3 copies. Lucretius, 2 copies. And what I love is when you're in the classics, in the classes, okay? And you're sitting there, you're listening to your professor, and you're reading Catullus, okay, in the Greek. I went through Homer in the original Greek, okay? Nobody ever said, you know, we've only got 2 copies, so we're not really sure that Catullus said this. We don't really know if this is accurate information from Catullus. They never said that. Okay, but that's all the copies they have. And then they got that big 1,400-year gapposis besides. Well, what is the second best attested book in the ancient world? Well, do you know what it is? It's Homer. How many copies do we have from the second best attested book of Homer? 643 copies of the Iliad exist. That's the second best in ancient history. Well, how many manuscripts, copies of the New Testament exist? Since we're supposed to have rotten information, not accurate, how few copies do we have compared to these others? At the present count, there are now 24,633 manuscript copies that have come down. But we're supposed to have inferior information. They say, we don't really know about your stuff. They got 2 copies over here. We got 24,000 over on this side. That's why, listen to these quotes. Now these quotes will make a little sense to you, okay? Dr. Bruce Metzger at Princeton, in his text of the New Testament, states, the works of several ancient authors are preserved to us by the thinnest possible thread of transmission. Aristotle, Plato, etc. In contrast with these figures, the textual critic of the New Testament is embarrassed by the wealth of his material. William F. Albright at Johns Hopkins said, only modern scholars who lack historical method and perspective can spin such a web of speculation as that with which critics have surrounded the gospel tradition. F.F. Bruce at Manchester, there is no body of ancient literature in the world which enjoys such a wealth of good textual attestation as the New Testament. Neighbors, you do not have to back off of saying that what you have in here is accurate historical information of Jesus written by eyewitnesses who were right on the scene. If you're going to doubt this stuff, then throw out ancient history. Now, you get the idea that we have accurate historical information?
Yeah.
Okay, I think I've pushed you over the line, all right? Well, now we can get down to the fun part. People say, oh, okay, you got accurate historical information about Jesus, but Jesus never said he was God. You read the New Testament. This is what you find in Newsweek. No place, they'll say, did Jesus just outright say that he was God? I hear this on campus all the time. Professors will tell your kids at the school that is the case. So what would you say to them? People say, well, you only need to know Greek and Hebrew and get to the fine nuances of these words. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that you can find it very easy. Let me give you an illustration. If I said to you, Mom and Dad, you're sitting around the breakfast table one morning, and your kid comes down, okay, your teenage son, and there you are having your cereal, and the family's together, and he says, folks, listen up. I got an announcement. Oh, yeah? He says, I want you to know, I am the light of the world. He that follows me, you'll never walk in darkness. What would you say? Dad would say, sit down, Jack, eat your cereal. If somebody comes along and says, I am the light of the world, if you all follow me, you'll never walk in darkness, we recognize that to be an egotistical claim. He's claiming to be above the rest of us. You don't need to know Greek and Hebrew to understand the meaning. Now, I want you to listen to some of the words that Jesus said and see what you think. Who do you think that he was claiming to be? Besides saying, I am the light of the world, in John chapter 8, verse 12. He also said, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth in me, notice the emphasis that Jesus puts on the personal pronoun. The religious leaders of the world all pointed people to somebody else. Muhammad said, go to Allah. Gandhi and others all pointed people to someplace else. Buddha never said, come to me. Only Jesus said, come to me. And put the emphasis, I am the light of the world. I am the resurrection and life. He that believeth in me, though you die, yet I'll let you live. Now, look at some of these others. John 14, 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me, Jesus said. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, Jesus said in Matthew 11, 28. Jesus said, I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger. He that believeth on me shall never thirst, in John chapter 6, 35. He was standing one day with the religious leaders, and he said, guys, you know Abraham, father of the Jewish nation? Abraham rejoiced to see my day. Well, they were about 1,500 years apart. These guys said, you got to be kidding. Abraham, the father of the Jewish nation, saw your day, Jesus? That's what he said. He went on to say, he says, not only that, you guys like Moses? He wrote about me. Oh, by the way, the whole scriptures that you believe are God's word, they're about me, Jesus said. Where do you find those? John chapter 8, verse 56, Abraham rejoiced to see his day, Jesus said. John 5, 46, Moses had written about him. John 5, 39, the scriptures bore witness to him. Jesus said, to know him was to know God. To see him was to see God. Where did he say that? John 14, 9. One day, he was standing with Philip. Philip said, hey, Jesus, show us God. Show us the Father. Now realize, Philip is an Orthodox Jew. He doesn't believe that there's a pantheon of gods out there. He believes there's only one God. He said, show us God. Show us the Father. Jesus said, Philip, haven't you been with me such a long time? He that has seen me has seen the Father. Now, what would that mean to an Orthodox Jew? If you've seen Jesus, you've seen God. Jesus said, to receive him was to receive God. In John chapter 16, verse 23, he said, if you hate Jesus, you hate God. To hate him was to hate God. If you don't give honor to Jesus, you're not giving honor to God. In Mark chapter 2, we looked at yesterday, Jesus claimed he could forgive men's sins. In John chapter 11, he claimed he could give all men eternal life. You want eternal life? When you die here, would you like to know that the life that exists beyond, eternal life in heaven, that Jesus, he says, he's the one that gives that. Who do you think he was saying he was? In Matthew 24, he claimed, we're going to forget Byron and Shakespeare, but his words will never pass away. In John chapter 12, he said, if I be lifted up from the earth, talking about his death on the cross, I will draw all men unto myself. Now in the Sermon on the Mount, I think you can see also that Jesus was claiming to be God. Remember when he said this? He said, guys, you have heard that it has been said, thou shalt not commit adultery. By the way, what was that? Thou shalt not commit adultery. Ten Commandments. One of the Ten Commandments. Where did they get that? Got it from Moses. Where did Moses get it? God. That was God's direct statement. He wrote it on the rock. Okay? Right on the stone. The Jews knew. Jesus said, you've heard this one said, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say unto you, and everybody went, oh my goodness. Listen, when God makes a statement, you don't go and say, now let me add something to that. Right? You've heard it has been said, thou shalt not commit adultery. But I say unto you, if a man looks on a woman and lusts in his heart, he's already broken that law. He was adding to it. Now, somebody said, well, listen, Jesus, you're getting into deep water here. You know, don't you know what you're saying? You're claiming that your authority is just as much authority as the very words of God. But then Jesus went on and he said, you have heard that it has been said, thou shalt not kill. But I say unto you, that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. If you just hate your brother in your heart, Jesus says, you've broken that law. And their mouths dropped open. And if you go to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, you'll find the words, the people were amazed because he taught as one who had authority and not like the scribes. What kind of authority? He was saying, God said this, I say this. He was putting his teachings right up there in authority with the very words of God, and the people recognized it. But let me give you one that I think is a real showstopper. Turn over to John chapter 8. If you've never seen this, I'm amazed at how many lay people have never seen this one. John chapter 8. Verse 56. Here's the spot where he starts out saying, your father, talking to the Jewish leaders, your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and he was glad. They came back and they said, hey, you're not even 50 years old yet. And you're saying, you've seen Abraham? Jesus said, I tell you the truth. Before Abraham was born, I am. Greek is ego eimi. At this, they picked up stones to stone him. And you know, when I'm talking to an audience, when they start reaching for the rocks, I always say, hey, what did I say? Now, why did these guys reach for the rocks? Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. Were they mad at him because his grammar was wrong? No. Go over to Exodus. Exodus. The book of Exodus, chapter 3. These Jewish leaders knew what Jesus was talking about, and when you see it, it'll blow your mind just like it blew their mind. Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. Moses is at the burning bush, and God is speaking to him, and he tells him to go and tell Pharaoh, let his people go. Who back at verse 13? Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I tell them? God said to Moses, verse 14, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation. Did the Jewish leaders know who the I am was? You bet your boots they did. And Jesus said, boys, you're looking at them. Before Abraham was, I am. I was there. I'm the one that brought your forefathers out of Egypt. I'm the I am. Ain't that a showstopper? Did they know who he was talking about? Take a look at Matthew chapter 27, 41. Jesus is on the cross. And it says, likewise also the chief priests mocking him with the scribes and the elders. The scribes and the elders. You got the honchos right there. The leaders of Israel. They're mocking Jesus on the cross. And they said, he, talking about Jesus, trusted in God. Let him deliver him now, if he will have him. For he, that's Jesus, said, I am the Son of God. Did they know what he was claiming to be? They taunted him with his own words on the cross. Go over to John chapter 10, verse 30. Through 33, Jesus said, I and my Father are one. Again, the Jews took up stones to stone him. Jesus answered them, many good works have I shown you from the Father. For which of those works do you stone me? The Jews answered him, saying, for a good work we stone thee not, but for blasphemy, the same thing we saw in Mark chapter 2 yesterday, because that thou, being a man, what does it say there? Makest thyself God. They said, you're claiming to be God. They understood what he's saying. Let me give you one because we're out of time. One more. Jesus said, folks, one day, the end of the world is coming. When it happens, I'm coming back and I'm going to gather all of the nations before me. Now that in itself, if somebody said, look, at the end of the world, I'm coming back and I'm going to gather all of the nations before me. And then I am going to determine the eternal destiny of every man, woman, and child that's ever lived. Let me give you his exact words. Matthew 25, 31, 32, he said, I will arouse the dead. All the nations will be gathered before him. He will sit on his throne in glory. He will then judge and separate men from one another as a shepherd separates his sheep from the goats. If you go back and hook that up with Matthew 7, 23, Jesus said, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be saying, Lord, Lord. They're going to use his name. They're going to say, didn't we do this? Didn't we do that? Didn't we do that? And he says at the judgment, he says, I'm going to look at them, and to some of them I'm going to say, I'm sorry, I never knew you, depart from me, into judgment. Now, I want to just center in on this one thing and close this. If you take all of these statements that Jesus made, it would seem that he's implying that he's very God. And if you accept that, then I want you to jump to the next part of your relationship with him, because Christianity is not just based on a person, it's a relationship with that person.
If you wish to receive information on future Compass conferences or wish to receive information on other audio and video products, call 1-800-977-2177.